Hi, this is Chris, and welcome to Foundations in Social Innovation. This podcast is being recorded on Kaurna land, and I'd like to pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and future, as well as to the traditional custodians of the lands on which you're listening today. In the last episode, we heard about how, when people and professionals work together, they can achieve the kinds of change that professionals can struggle to achieve on their own, even on issues that professionals have been stuck on for decades. We heard how women in Cape Town who were HIV positive were more effective in getting other mothers to take their medication than doctors. We heard how, in lockdown in Adelaide in South Australia, survivors of domestic violence collaborated with professionals to design and deliver a new program to support other survivors of domestic violence. We heard how all over Indonesia, everyday people make decisions about how to spend public money. And we heard how a representative group of Irish people broke a political deadlock that's at least 3 decades long to legalize abortion and gay marriage. That episode focused on what was done in a participatory way. Deciding, designing, delivering. This episode focuses on the how of participation. How to make decisions informed by lived expertise. How to share decision-making between people and professionals. And how to empower communities to lead their own change. So I want you to imagine a group of professionals, well-intentioned, smart, competent, kind of people who really want to do the best they can for the people that they serve. Let's say they work in mental health for young people. Maybe they're civil servants working in the government, allocating budgets, or maybe they're staff of a foundation working on the next granting round. But for the purposes of this episode, let's say they're a service delivery organisation responding to a tender and shaping a plan to deliver a new service. So I want you to visualise how they go about making decisions. You can imagine them in a meeting, maybe on a Zoom call. They'd probably start by talking about what's asked in the tender. But then, because they're good people, they'd go on to talk about what they know about the mental health needs of young people. They might draw on research, and they might have worked in mental health services for a long time, so they might know what's worked and what didn't work from the things that they've tried. Then, all these perspectives considered, and probably after a few more meetings and after a few drafts of the tender, they'd make an informed decision as to what that new service would be. And this, my friends, is how most decisions get made, based on professional expertise in meetings or on the page. Most often in small groups, but sometimes in larger meetings that involve lots of professionals, maybe even professionals of all different kinds. This is how we make a lot of decisions about our organisation at Taxi, about the service we provide, about the practice, about how we budget. But maybe it's not always the best way to make decisions. And certainly, it's a highly risky way of making decisions when your aim is to create outcomes for people who are not you. And for the most part, the staff of service providers, of foundations, in government, of intermediaries like Taxi, or even advocacy groups, are not representative of the people they serve. And even if an organisation has lived experienced staff, they would not be representative of the full diversity of the communities with lived experience. And can we expect our Gen Z 30 and 40-something service providers to have a thorough understanding of the full diversity of the 20-somethings they want to help with their service? No, we could not. So I might generously call this informed decision-making, in that it's informed by professionals' interpretation of the real world, and their interpretation of people's experience living in it. But Kellyanne McKercher, who's a real champion of participatory working and a former Taxi staffer, calls this making decisions at people. Presumably, Because when you're at the end of decisions made this way that don't work for you, it can feel like a kind of violence. You feel done to. And that is a result nobody wants. So this is where participatory processes can come into play. They can address some of the risks that professionals might bias the results, and as a result, lead to better decisions. Participatory processes give people with lived expertise of a particular situation, for example, of living in a particular community or living with mental illness, a greater say, even the final say, in shaping responses to the issues they experience day to day. And there's not one way to do participation. There are many, and they vary in who makes the decisions and how those decisions are shaped. So right now, on their Zoom call, our service providers are the people who will shape and make the decisions based on their own professional expertise and interpretation. They haven't directly engaged a single young person, let alone the full diversity of young people who might want to use the services they're designing. If you sat our service providers on one end of a seesaw, and young people living with mental illness on the other, the seesaw would be fully tipped towards the professionals. They'd be sitting on the ground because they hold the weight of power. They make the decisions and they shape them. But what if we could convince those professionals to tip the balance the other way, just a little, so that those young people with lived experience of mental illness had a bit more of a chance to shape those decisions that the professionals will make? If we could do that, we'd be dipping into what I'll call consultative ways of working. Professionals still hold the decision-making power here, but it's shaped through consultation with people who have direct experience of the challenge. On their seesaw, our professionals momentarily tip the balance into the real world, listen to the people with lived experience, before tipping it back to make the decision. Of course, professionals do consultations all the time, surveys or town hall type meetings, in person or online, and these have their value. They're useful where there's a known problem and a known set of solutions, and people have the knowledge and the insight to speak up. Solutions for urban cycling, for example, might be one place where consultation would get a good result. There are a clear set of solutions. They are known. Of course, professionals do consultations all the time, surveys and town hall meetings, in person or online. And these have their value. They're useful where there's a known problem, a known set of solutions, and people have the knowledge and the confidence to speak up. Solutions for urban cycling might be one example where consultations will get a good result. There's a clear set of solutions, those solutions are broadly known, and the people who cycle in cities are often quite capable of representing their views. But in many social challenges, the problems and the solutions are not clear to anybody. People might not have the confidence to speak up in a public forum. And anyway, they're probably going to be too busy in their lives to show up at these things or to fill in a survey. And because of these reasons, many forms of public consultation actually exclude those who are already marginalised by systems. So we need our service providers to embrace a kind of consultation that reaches out to people where they are, that's compassionate, individualized, and reaches out to people in their context to find out about the situation, about what people see as a potential solution, to get people's feedback on prototypes, to get their feedback on delivery. Our professionals would need to get off their seesaw and out into the field to talk with young people. They'd be using semi-structured interviews, rapid ethnography. They'd be carefully gathering feedback about prototypes. Wherever a critical decision is to be made, they'd recognize the need to inform those decisions by getting out in the field. And if we do take up this kind of work, one of our responsibilities is to engage an appropriate diversity of people and to engage them ethically and with compassion.
So before we sort of go into the time when you do connect, when you first reach out to people and you're wanting to connect with them to say, hey, I'm Carla and I'd love to have this conversation, how do you go about that and how do you help people make a genuine choice about whether they want to be part of that and give their consent for their story to be shared?
This is a little bit of a snippet of a conversation between Carrie Jones, Taxi's Director of Systems Initiatives, and Carla Clarence, a principal in our Sydney team. And they're really exploring what it takes to engage people with lived experience in co-design processes. How you get that started?
Again, I think it's got a lot to do with all those lovely things you were just saying, Carrie, about like how we position our hearts and minds before we approach that person. And I think it is about, you know, if I think about what is it that I say to people, you know, I'm sort of hearing what I do say to people in my own head now, and often it's something around, you know, I've just got such a feeling that there's so much that we could learn from you. And I don't know what that actually is right now, or I often go into a bit of the unknown space and say, you know, we could just have a conversation that is a way where if you feel comfortable, I could perhaps ask you some questions. You might want to share a story with me. But essentially, I think what's at the crux of it is just asking people. It's the ask, the invitation, and then the ask. I also think it's actually about really cutting to the chase. You know, most people don't enjoy a fluffy conversation. And to be honest, the people, the really rigid-edge folk that have seen life for all it is and have got so much to teach us, they're actually really strong and incredibly resilient and really courageous. And they're actually often a lot more willing and best prepared to go into these sorts of conversations than I ever will be. So I often sort of just try and have, I guess, some of those gestures around, you know, I would love to learn with you and from you. You know, obviously around consent, it's always about saying at any time, you know, if you wanted to retract your story, change, take a break, you know, you ensure that, you know, the conditions around you feel safe and comfortable. I think it is that simple. I don't think you need a lot of sort of bells and whistles around it, because again, people will usually tell you what it is that will keep them safe. And often, and too, like in the, a lot of the conditions around safety, I feel like, especially working with Adele and I, we're not sort of trying to create the conditions of safety. We're asking people, what makes you feel safe? Mm-hmm. What do you want to create here? This is your space, and we're so privileged to be in it with you.
So this kind of contextual consultation where we're reaching out to people where they are is the approach we use to design Family by Family, Taxi's peer-to-peer service, where families that have gone through tough times support other families who are in the middle of it. In that project, it was through hanging out with families and asking them to talk about what they saw as helpful help that we learned that help more often came from another family than a professional. And so we designed a peer-to-peer service as a result. Mitch Besser took a consultative approach with HIV-affected mothers in Cape Town to develop Mothers to Mothers. It's the approach the Arrols used when they consulted with a nurse to develop a new health response in Jamkhed. And in all of these examples, professionals made the decisions, but they were highly influenced by what they saw and heard from people living the experience they were trying to change. The strength, as I see it, of consultative processes is that they can fit well with existing power structures. But there are some very valid critiques of this approach, because it still leaves professionals making the decisions, and they could still make those false interpretations of lived experience. After all, they're only momentarily dipping into the real world of lived experience before dipping out again. You might spend an hour, a day, a week, a month perhaps, in context, learning, but that doesn't give you the ability to think and perceive the world of someone who isn't you. If you are running a consultative process, you can mitigate these risks somewhat by paying explicit attention to them, by getting multiple rounds of feedback from participants, and by holding yourself to a strong set of principles. But at the end of the day, this still leaves professionals making decisions for people with lived experience, not with them. Let's help our group of service providers take the next step down the path of participation and share decision-making with people with lived experience. So now our seesaw is balanced. Professionals and lived experience have equal weight. They both shape the decisions and they both make them. This is how the Sturdins worked in Vietnam when they shared decision-making to address child malnutrition with villagers. And it's how Danny Madsen and team worked together to develop the virtual village.
Sure. So the Virtual Village is a peer-to-peer virtual support program where we take volunteers with lived experience of domestic violence, drug and alcohol misuse or homelessness, and we connect them to somebody who is isolated and is either currently or has recently left domestic violence, homelessness or drug and alcohol misuse. In partnership with Uniting Communities and also with Department of Human Services. So what we did is we formed a co-design group out of those partners that was made up of both practitioners and people who would be potentially be delivering a service like this, families and the families who would be receiving or volunteering on a service like this, and also referrers and people who would see value in referring families that they knew were struggling into a service like this. So we formed that group, and we met with that group weekly, and every week we brought different challenges to that group and really openly kind of discussed or role-played, tried ideas that would be helpful, not just for the families, but for the people who were sitting around supporting those families. So the families were able to say, no, that wouldn't work. That's a terrible idea. Families will never do that because of whatever. But also practitioners will say, well, that really doesn't work for us as a system. There's no way we could do that. And we were able to use that information to find a middle ground, but B, ideas to just test live and quickly to see if they would work if we were to put them into the real world.
Each step we take further along the participatory pathway, we need to pick up an extra set of responsibilities. The first, at the outset, is the responsibility to be aware of our own cognitive biases and address them and mitigate them as much as we can. Then, when we start to engage with people with lived experience, we have to think about how to engage a representative diversity of people and engage with people compassionately and ethically. And then, in order to share decision-making, we need to actively create the conditions that balance power in the room, as much as that's possible, so that everyone who participates, public and professionals, have the confidence, the information, the capabilities and the feeling of safety to participate, to make decisions and to inform their own thinking through consultation with people who are not them. Kellyanne McKercher calls this working with. And their book, Sticky Notes, is one of the best books I know about participatory practices, participatory ways of working, and how to create the conditions for people and professionals to share power. It focuses on the design phase, but I think the practices that the book describes are relevant to planning, design, delivery, or evaluation. I'm going to read to you the first part of a chapter called Power, Privilege, and Equity. We can't do co-design without seeing and addressing power differentials between individuals and groups. Power differences often prevent people from working together in meaningful ways, if at all. Power is the ability to bring about a change in your life or the lives of others. A lack of power tends to be felt most strongly by people who have little of it, while people who have lots of power often struggle to see how much they have compared to others who have less. Here are some ways that people have more power. Membership of a majority group and dominant culture, e.g. a profession, ethnicity, gender, or sexuality. Inherited privileges, e.g. being born into a wealthy family, being born white, being born in a good neighbourhood. Wellness and ability, education and knowledge, connections with powerful people, experience, reputation and public regard, perceived creativity, decision-making authority, money and financial assets, effective and influential communication, extroversion or gregariousness, physical appearance. Recognizing power differentials in co-design. Given co-design is about unlocking people's contribution, it's critical that we see and share power. Within co-design, people with less power often can't take part in an equal way, hence the importance of cultural change in systems and organisations. The need to increase our collective power literacy and implement models of care for co-design. Once we start seeing power, we can't look away from it. Tip: co-design isn't smooth sailing. Conflict and confrontation will happen. Power imbalances affect who can take part in co-design. When people don't feel safe or valued, they can't stay included, even if they want to. When that happens, co-design conveners have failed. Here are some instances where people with less power can't participate meaningfully in co-design. People can't trust that their critical feedback will be heard or acted on. Or if it is heard, people worry that it will create adverse consequences, such as a loss of access to service or financial supports. People can't challenge professionals when they are wrong, promote poor or dangerous ideas, or lack an understanding of lived and felt experience. People can't raise issues or barriers with conveners of co-design, resulting in co-design practices and processes that aren't as safe as they could or should be. People can't provide critical feedback on outputs, such as research reports, that aren't reflective of lived reality, and ideas that are demeaning, ill-fitting, and undesirable. Marginalised people tend to be excluded from co-design when we assume that commercial design methods will work equally well in social design settings. Unsurprisingly, they don't. Many commercial design methods fail to consider power, neurodiversity, or the impact of trauma. Insights and solutions will always be weaker when we miss the perspectives of people with lived experience who are prevented from sharing their views and ideas. Often that's where the most learning comes from, if we know how to listen to it. Tip: in co-design, conveners prioritise the safety of marginalised people over the comfort of privileged people. Facilitators are often confused as to why people don't speak up in sessions, mistaking silence for progress. Often it's because the participants are uncomfortable. Other times, facilitators ask for feedback without demonstrating they want to hear it. For example, not giving participants enough time to answer a question, using non-receptive body language, or being dismissive or defensive when people offer suggestions. When there's a power imbalance, participants will often nod and agree, even when they're uneasy and confused. Interactions and group dynamics that can seem inconsequential to people with more power can be a lot for somebody who's tired and battle-weary. Like the straw that breaks the camel's back, small acts that make people feel uncomfortable add up over time. tip. People with less power shouldn't have to make themselves heard. People with more power must create more safety, generosity, and hospitality. Alongside a lack of power, people may choose silence and agreement to avoid more suffering. Some families have learned that speaking up can result in the removal of resources or family members whilst landing them squarely in the dreaded troublemaker camp. If people aren't believed or treated with compassion when sharing their stories and feedback, they stop. Wouldn't you? In those kinds of situations, speaking out can be scary and it can undermine recovery. How might we change that? How can we improve our capacity to listen? Many organisations tell me they receive hardly any negative feedback. Having interviewed hundreds of people who use services, I know plenty of it exists. However, it's not often asked for or heard. Very few organisations have the enabling structures to hear critical feedback. More often, people must go out of their way to reach out, rather than organisations doing the work, and are met with dismissal, if not outright hostility. Too often, professionals choose to defend their organisation and actions instead of listening and learning. In co-design, conveners must model listening and power sharing and support other professionals to do the same. Tip. If your organisation has a history of selective listening, work extra hard to demonstrate your capacity to listen and learn without adverse repercussions for people who speak up. Examining privilege. Unchecked privileges can lead us to make incorrect and naive assumptions about what others should be able to do. For example, that people with chronic illness just won't get a job or should just look after themselves better. We assume that the pathways available to us are also available to everyone else. Tip: if shaming people was effective, our systems would work perfectly. Unpacking privilege helps us to see that what's easy for us isn't easy for people who have less privilege. Co-design practitioners must be extremely self-aware of their identity, power, and privilege, especially in relation to the people they work with. Increasing power literacy in design. Traditionally, design and designers have had little to no language about power. This is changing, though, through the work of wonderful people such as Sasha Konster Chok, George A. and Lauren Weinstein, among many others. Designers can be complicit in reproducing inequality, for example, continuing to serve the aspirations of one group whilst ignoring or undermining another's. Or designers may support influential people to perpetuate stigma. Tip: if we don't know what the game is, designers can be an unwilling pawn. Unlike fields such as social work and sociology, designers have historically learned little to no social theory, nor have we been required to unpack our privilege before stepping into the lives of families and communities. I include myself in this. I'm a designer from privilege. Tip: no single discipline has the answers. We have to learn from each other. As a discipline, design needs to go beyond itself and draw on broader practices and theories such as systems theory and trauma studies, as well as understanding whiteness, race, class, and social disadvantage. Without these things and more, we're stumbling in the dark. When I'm working with a new team or organization, I often ask them about where they think power shows up in their work, where they might be missing people's contributions because of too much or too little power. I'm usually met with blank faces in a very silent room. Examining power, or how to clear a room. Tony Benn, British parliamentarian, named five essential questions of democracy, which we can apply to ourselves and to co-design. What power have you got? Where did you get it from? In whose interests do you exercise it? To whom are you accountable? How can we get rid of you? I once incorporated those questions into co-design training with service managers. When answering the question, what power do you have? People talked about the skills they'd developed, their qualifications and their experience. No one spoke about their being part of a majority group or dominant culture, or their wellness. Alarmingly, no one talked about having more power than the communities they typically served, which are some of the most marginalised in the region. Several people even said they exercised their power on behalf of the organisation, instead of behalf of the communities they were employed to support. How about you? Where did you get your power from? In whose interests do you exercise it? Exercising power in partnership. Exercising power in partnership is a core practice of co-design, recognising that both professionals and people with lived experience have vital contributions to make. In co-design, we aim to partner in ways that are liberating, meaningful, and dignified for everyone involved. For this to happen, all parties need to be able to participate in decision-making.
I'm here with Lucy Fraser from TACSI, and tell me a little bit about what kinds of projects you've been working on.
At the moment, I'm working on community responses to asthma management in Peterborough, Jamestown and Oraru with Asthma Australia. I'm working on community responses to mental health in the Eyre Peninsula with some young people and Mentally Fit Eyre Peninsula, a fantastic organisation there. And I'm also working with young South Sydney Australians in Western Metropolitan Melbourne around responding to mental health there as well. And all of those are co-design projects with working with young people and people with lived experience to come up with new solutions.
When you're working with diverse communities, as you have been with the South Sudanese Australian community, how do you set up projects like that for success when you're not from that community yourself?
I think being really open and honest about that is a good start, to just acknowledge that you aren't from that community and that you can't represent that community, and that it's not one community but many. I think one of the important things is to really do your homework and make sure that you can understand what's already known about some of the sort of challenges and opportunities and strengths of that particular cultural group, so that you're not going in and asking questions that researchers or designers might have asked before. And so you're sort of letting people know that you've listened to what they've already said, and you want to build on that. I think another one is to be really clear on what value you can offer, so that you're not being purely extractive. You're not going into communities and networks to just purely learn from them, but you can also offer them opportunities for skill development or paid roles or the opportunity to broadcast their story to a wider audience, or there are many things that people might find valuable from your engagement with them. I think it's important to work alongside community members, so building relationships with people who are in a position where they can comfortably walk between two worlds and be a sort of element of cultural safety when you might go into talk to people and things like that, that they can be a guide, a cultural guide, or even better, they can ask those questions themselves and sort of share with you the outcomes.
And what is that? Could you say a little bit about what building relationships looks like? In this latest project with South Sydney's Australians, what does that look like? What have you been doing?
Yeah, so I think one of the best ways to do it is to connect with people that already have relationships. So I guess for us, in the first piece of work where we didn't have any personal relationships in the community, we were introduced to people through CoHealth, who's the managing organisation. And so they were able to introduce us to others and share the trust that people had in them, extend that to us, so that we had the sort of approval or the backing of someone that was trusted within the community, and that we could then move forward. I think we also, in the beginning, we also let some of the sort of known community leaders know that we were doing the work and sort of said that this is an opportunity that we'd love to hear your perspective about. So we were really asking the right people, I guess, to get involved who needed to have their say heard and needed to know that that work was happening within their own communities. I think this second piece of work's been a bit easier because we had those relationships, so we were able to tap into the people that we already knew and then put out a call for the sort of roles that we were looking for or the people that we were looking to talk to. So it gets certainly gets easier over time, but you need that sort of first connection to then start snowballing.
Oh, Nara, I wonder if there's times that you feel you've sort of stuffed up in kind of engaging appropriately with diverse communities. I don't know if there's some stories that you'd be willing to share for the benefit of others there.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, you're always going to stuff up. I think that's something you need to be ready for and know that you need to figure that out when you do that and say sorry and do what needs to be done to be able to sustain those relationships. I think some times that I've stuffed up have probably been when I've had a few assumptions about what the people that I were working was trying to work with wanted and the kind of involvement that they'd like to have in a project based on what I needed from them. So probably going in a bit too with too much of a clear role of a clear idea of what I wanted and saying this is what you'd have to do, rather than having a conversation with someone and saying, you know, we're doing this project, we'd love some help with this, here are our gaps, what do you think you can help with. So I've definitely had a few relationships that didn't work out, and that can be tough, especially in a really tight-knit community. That can sort of damage your reputation in a community, and people might know that, yeah, you're not to be trusted or things like that. But we managed to, I guess, heal enough and sort of not push that too far that we were able to recover from that and be able to build relationships with other people as well who did feel like they were, I guess, they're in a place where they were more comfortable to participate in the ways that we needed, but also like we became more flexible and like, yep, let's work out how you can participate in a way that works for you as well. So coming into sort of into the middle.
I think a bit of a theme through your projects is you've really been creating roles for people that are from the community. Can you say a little bit about sort of how you thought about shaping those roles, the kinds of roles they are, and sort of how you go about setting them up as well?
I guess we start with what we need to do, what's the sort of outcome that we're trying to get to, and work from there, as well as what the sort of capacity and those sorts of things are available from our end. So what kinds of support we can offer people and what kinds of support we can't. So I think in the first project we had peer researcher roles where it was really a alongside role where we were sort of doing work with people. So we would go interview, do interviews together, and then we'd do analysis together. And I think, you know, because we then learned a lot and we had these strong relationships in this project, we were able to push that a little bit further and have roles that were a bit more independent and sort of have support that's more behind the scenes and trying to find people to lead pieces of work. So I think we probably wouldn't have been able to do that without the knowledge that we had and the sort of relationships that we had of the community beforehand to know what we needed to set up to support people, know how to communicate that particular role, and also sort of, I guess, know how to articulate that sort of leadership that we were looking for. Yeah, so different roles for different kinds of projects and as relationships evolve over time.
I think in the setup of many of these projects, there are you know, well-intentioned but white dominant culture organisations that are holding the project, so which could include, you know, taxi or own organisation, and holding the money, and that can be, I can see that could kind of put a real tension in place when also it's important to go at the pace of community. And yeah, I wondered if you had sort of examples or reflections on sort of how to set up projects well for that, or about how you can think about how white organisations might think about ceding control over some of that funding or all of that funding, and the role of kind of governance over projects from communities themselves.
That's right. Governance is a really important one, and we do have a group of people that are in the governance team for this project, and their responsibility is to guide the work and help inform decisions, and to make sure that we're doing the best that we can to get the outcome that we're working towards. And they are, the governance group is made up of like white organisations who are funding, but also a majority of South Sudanese Australians. So there are people who are South Sudanese Australians within organisations, but also South Sudanese Australians who are in community. And obviously those aren't mutually exclusive. People sit across those. So sometimes we do have to be explicit about what hat people are wearing when they're in the meeting, or at different times in the meeting. We're asking for different hats. So that's been really key into making sure that when we're making a decision, that there is a majority who are from the communities who are making that sort of final call. And we do have decision making that is opened to the broader communities as well throughout, through polls, surveys, conversations, group discussions, interviews, so that we are hearing the broader opinions along the way. I think before all of that happens, to set things up well, you do want to have a partnership with organisations who have values that are aligned to those things, and who are willing to at least talk about how to share power. And I think the organisations that we have on this project are really set up for success with that. They have really aligned values around that. And for them, what's important is getting good outcomes. It's not getting a report at the end. And they've been really excellent at navigating within their own systems to make sure we have the flexibility that we need to respond not only to the cultural needs of the community and the things that we learn along the way, but also global crisis that happens to come up mid-project and things like that. So we've had really great open conversations about some of the tensions that are in the projects, but also reminding each other of what are we really here for, and are we doing what we can to work towards that.
I think it's important in these things to make some abstract concepts concrete. So things like sharing power, I wonder if you could just talk, like, what does that look like for a white organization, for example, that might be sitting with the funding? Like what do they do?
So I think that there are lots of inherent things in the design of this project that do share power. And that's probably one of the reasons that we are doing this work, because that's what CoHealth was looking for. So I think things like taking a co-design approach, that's sharing power already. Also to have a governance group with a majority from the communities, that's sharing power too. We have, I guess on an individual level, people are needing to reflect on their own power and privilege and how they can set themselves up for working with that and sharing that in meetings. So there is the need to call each other out sometimes on things or behaviour where we might be holding our own power and not realising it, or like keeping people out of a conversation or things like that. So there is a really open dialogue where we're constantly checking in with each other. You know, I'm often contacting CoHealth and saying, hey, you know, I'm thinking of doing it this way. What do you think? Do you feel comfortable with that? And I'm talking to community members and saying, hey, we're thinking of doing it this way. What do you think about that? And sort of being a bit of a conduit between the two to find an approach that sort of is doable, but also is respecting people's culture and identity. And I think, you know, CoHealth is, they have really strong values that are aligned to power sharing, and you know, they've been able to call me out a couple of times to say, like, okay, we can actually do better than that, and push me to and our team to be better at sharing power.
Would you be able to say what some of those things were?
I think one of the challenges is in recruitment is finding like enough people to fill the roles that you need who have the experience that that you need as well. And I think we had some sort of applications that weren't quite the right cultural fit, but we thought we could add value with their experience. And CoHealth just sort of called us out and said, you know, they might be an asset to the project in terms of their skills, but that's not a culturally safe option for the team. So you need to find a way to work around that. and look like just look back into the strengths that do exist in the community and adapt the process if you need to.
There's one more step we can take along the participatory pathway, and in a sense it's beyond participation and into self-determination, where communities and communities of people with lived experience make the decisions and lead the change work for themselves. And this is, of course, what Aboriginal communities have been calling for decades in Australia. It's the clarion call of the Uluru Statement. But it's also an approach that's relevant to other communities. Taxis use this approach with South Sudanese Australian communities in Greater Melbourne, for example, who are seeking to create outcomes for within their own community, as well as with rural towns in South Australia who are on a path to self-determining their own mental well-being in a project called Our Town. The additional responsibility that comes with this part of the pathway is to create the conditions and capabilities for communities to lead. And this has to be done carefully through a series of intentional transitions of power and capability and money and so on. And this is especially true if leading change work is new to communities.
Communities are the experts in what's going on in their lives, in their communities, with their children, with their parents, whatever. And we need to listen to that, you know. And I think if people are leading something, they're more invested. If it's just another group coming in saying, oh, let's do this, you know. So by making it community-led, they've got ownership of it, they've got investment, they're activated, you know, they're mobilised to create that change for themselves.
Experience overall was really good. I felt really included by the team, and we felt that we had some really good insights gained from community consultation, and we have some really good ideas going forward, so we're excited about that.
I've noticed a real mindset shift with all of our region, or the bulk of our region, around we can do stuff for ourselves rather than council need to do this, services need to, schools need to, you know, whatever it might be. It's something that I've really seen over the last year. Initially it was, we can't respond to mental health, we don't have any services, whereas now they're kind of going, actually, what can we do? You know, so that real mindset shift has been a real learning curve, I think, for all of us across that community.
My vision would be around the connectedness of the town and the communities, from the sporting club to the school to the caravan park to the pub, just working together with a common understanding and a common language that really promotes well-being from birth.
Our Town is an 11-year, $15 million initiative funded by the Faith Fuller Foundation to help rural communities in South Australia to self-determine their mental well-being. I recently worked with a support team, a partnership between Taxi, the Faith Fuller Foundation and Clear Horizon, to help them identify what they learned from their first year of work with communities and what they do differently next time. Two lessons in particular seemed relevant to share here. The first is about the importance of distributing and growing power in communities through a series of intentional transitions. So at the outset, Our Town didn't start as a community-led initiative. It was led by the support team before it transitioned to being a community-led initiative. And this change took a series of intentional transitions that collectively created the conditions for communities to lead their own change. So key transitions included the shift from the funder shaping the initiative to the support team shaping the initiative, the strengthening of town teams in their organisation and their capability, the distribution of long-term funds with fewer requirements around them, and ultimately from the support team setting the agenda of the initiative to the town setting the agenda for the initiative. And to do this, the support team found themselves fighting against the cultural and organisational norms, which mean that it's almost natural to set up a place-based initiative in a way that gives significant power to the funder. And that can leave communities delivering on what funders want rather than what communities need. And what's more, this kind of structure is poor at responding to complexity because it takes decision making away from where the action happens on the ground in communities. So for our town, the support team were determined to set up a dynamic that put town teams on a track to self-determination and positioned town teams and the support team as allies in creating changes across systems of mental well-being, aligned to a common aim, but each playing a different role. A while back, I interviewed Stacey Thomas, who's the inaugural CEO of the Faithful Foundation. And she told me, when we really thought about what it would take to have an authentic relationship with people, handing over the decision-making seemed like the best way. Kerry Jones, who you heard earlier, described to me how supporting effective transitions in leadership has often meant the support team cycling between front stage and backstage roles in a three-part movement. Working front stage to introduce new capabilities and models of practice. Working shoulder to shoulder to build town's confidence to use new practices. And then working backstage to let towns lead their own work, resisting temptation and resisting requests for direct help when communities already had the capabilities themselves.
The way we really have and constantly challenging ourselves to be that that support base that you see in that image rather than being in the front or doing for all that kind of stuff that actually unintentionally builds dependency. Like we you have to really work consciously at, oh, is it something that we should be doing because communities are asking us for this, or is this something we're doing because we feel like we should be helpful? You know, we just like you're really kind of, or that you're not, like it was a little bit of a dynamic shift even in the coaching where people were like, oh, so you'll come and do this. Like no, we're supporting you to do this. It's, you know, so not being the front facilitator out in a community, for example, that's going to be kind of as behind the scenes as possible. And whenever we're front stage, we end up in the system that is a community in what I think is an unhelpful way.
And it wasn't always easy for the support team to stay backstage. They learned to say less in network meetings to give towns more time to talk. And they learned the value in simplifying the tools they provided towns and learned the importance of keeping pace with towns and working at the pace of community.
Even for Sejuna, when we did their visit, I'll draw on them as example again, when we did their visit where they were doing the point where they'd really synthesize their insights and they're wanting to test them with broader community members, and they were kind of looking to us to run that session. We're like, no, we're going to actually stand at the back of the room and try and be as invisible as possible. And, you know, just that, you know, it has to be really conscious that you know where your space is from that real sort of enabler backstage crew. I always talk about it like the backstage crew in a performance.
Our Town is an initiative that is looking at community-led mental health. So the exciting thing with Our Town is that we get to go and speak to community and hear their voice and capture their voice and then create a plan that is very much about what's needed in each separate community.
Our slogan is we are a can-do community, and it really resides in our pride of how we actually band together and network in times of difficulty, and we really look out for one another.
The reason that I thought Our Town was for us was because we do continue to see suicide attempts and suicide rates in our community, and nothing seemed to be touching the sides. And we have a lot of people in our community that believed that we didn't have a problem. And what Our Town did was it gave us the discovery part that we could actually dig a little bit deeper and find the real source of what the problems were in the community rather than just assuming that what we had seen in the past was what was happening.
If you can eliminate the possibility of even getting sick from the start, then why wouldn't you?
The second lesson from that first year of working with communities was about the significance of social innovation as an approach for community learning and alignment. Over the 12 months, the support team built six towns' capabilities in social innovation and supported them through a staged innovation process to learn about their town's well-being, to listen to really interesting people to fill the gaps in their knowledge, to identify big opportunities for action, to develop ideas, and then to form a plan from everything they'd learned. And we know this early stage social innovation process worked well for towns because it meant that towns could quickly articulate, test, and revise their assumptions. It meant that towns could bring together different sources of knowledge, data, research evidence, leading edge practice, and lived experience to inform opportunities and ideas. It meant that towns could build ownership around local problems and opportunities and discover them together. A secondary benefit of this learning is that these social innovation competencies could support the towns to address a whole range of local issues, not just mental health. The town teams learned to unpack local issues, to collectively develop a plan to address them, and then to work with the full diversity of their communities. As Jess Dart, an evaluator, told me, the towns have learned to learn, and with that, they can tackle anything.